Listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SFU's community radio station broadcasting live from Burnaby, BC.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
It's here to show our appreciation. The trophy says the undisputed champion of beautiful clean coal. Thank you, sir.
Now, later today, President Trump's going to announce a new executive order directing the Department of War to purchase electricity from coal-fired plants.
The party told you to reject the evidence of your eyes and ears. It was their final, most essential command.
It's the greatest con job ever perpetrated on the world, in my opinion. Climate change, no matter what happens, you're involved in that. No more global warming, no more global cooling, all of these predictions made by the United Nations and many others, often for bad reasons, were wrong. They were made by stupid people.
Pump it all up, call it natural. Wouldn't hurt a fly if we fill the sky. Would I tell a lie? Would I hide the dark?
Attention.
Big money rolling in. Buy out every sin out there in the dark.
It's official. The president has declared American climate science dead. It was all just a great green con job, according to Trump. He removed the pillar policy, saying greenhouse gases and polluting smog are not endangering your health. In this show, you will hear how other countries, Germany, the UK, and Canada, covered fossil fuels' nightmarish last stand, where the world's leaders in science once stood. We get reaction outside the dome of America's captured big media. But first, the inside story of Trump's war against climate science, as told by Dr. Ben Santer. Dr. Santer is an internationally recognized atmospheric scientist. He played a pivotal role in the 1995 IPCC finding of discernible human influence on global climate. Santer worked decades at the federally funded Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, publishing a long list of highly cited papers. He helped build the field and then showed proof climate change increased the number and severity of disasters, droughts, abnormal waves of heat. The fingerprints of climate were all over these extreme events. Santer was interviewed by Carbon Brief senior science editor Robert McSweeney at Carbon Brief's offices in London in January 2026.
And thanks very much for joining us. So after a long career in the US, you're now relocating to the UK, where you studied for your degrees. What has prompted your return?
It's really difficult for me to continue doing work in attribution science in the United States in 2026. I'm a scientist working on identification of human fingerprints on climate is in my lifeblood. It's part of who I am, it's part of what I've done for the last 40 years. The notion of not being able to do that work anymore in the United States is unacceptable to me. So that's one of the reasons why I'm moving to the UK, to continue to do work in trying to disentangle human and natural effects on climate. I'm also coming to the UK because my partner lives here and I want to be with her.
In Trump's first term, you were at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory. I wonder what impacts did you experience of a Trump administration when you were there?
A number of impacts, and those impacts started right at the beginning of the first Trump administration. Trump's nominee for the Environmental Protection Agency, Scott Pruitt, when he was nominated, had to go through Senate confirmation hearings. During those confirmation hearings, he was asked about the reality and seriousness of climate change. He responded that there had been no significant global warming since 1998. 1998 was a big natural El Nino, natural warming event, and Mr. Pruitt was cherry picking. He was saying, when I look at satellite temperature records of the temperature of the lower atmosphere, the troposphere, and only go back to 1998 and then march forward in time, I believe there's been no significant warming. That was wrong, demonstrably so. My colleagues and I at Lawrence Livermore National Lab were asked to investigate Mr. Pruitt's claim. We did. We published a paper in 2017 in Journal of Climate showing that that claim was wrong, even if one did the cherry picking and forgot about the pre-1998 portion of the satellite temperature record. The LA Times reported on our Journal of Climate paper, and I think it's fair to say that the Trump administration did not like that we had fact-checked Mr. Pruitt and did not like that we had shown that his on-the-record statement to the U.S. Senate was wrong. That incident led to a complaint by the Trump Department of Energy, the funder, primary funder of Lawrence Livermore National Lab, to the director of Lawrence Livermore National Lab. The director asked for a meeting with me, and during that meeting told me that the Trump administration was in a position to cut my funding for detection and attribution research at Livermore, and indeed to cut funding for Lawrence Livermore National Lab. In the end, the Trump administration did cut the funding for my research and my group's research in climate change detection and attribution. In my opinion, that was a direct result of doing science fact-checking Mr. Pruitt. The administration didn't like that, and they didn't like the result of the fact-checking.
So how were you able to kind of continue your research at the time?
I was able to continue my research by cutting down the amount of time that I was actually paid by the Department of Energy. So essentially, I reduced my time at Livermore in order to allow my younger colleagues to continue to do this critically important work. At the time of these cuts, I had been in my position at Livermore for nearly three decades. I was at the tail end of my career. They were not. My younger colleagues were not. And I wanted them to continue to have sufficient funding to do this work.
Kind of fast forward to this Trump second term, and there have been reported cuts to climate science and related programs at the EPA, NCAR, NOAA, NASA. I wonder which of these concerns you the most.
They are all of deep concern to me. I would say the administration, the second Trump administration, has engaged in a systematic attempt to dismantle climate science, and not only climate science in the United States, but I know the climate science piece of things reasonably well. They've gone after monitoring. They've gone after computer modeling. They've gone after people who do the kind of attribution science work that I do, people who look at extreme events and human contribution to the changes in the properties of extreme events, droughts, flooding, all of that. They've fired thousands of employees. And when you break the evidentiary chain, when you no longer monitor, say, changes in Arctic sea ice extent or carbon emissions or atmospheric temperature, you make it difficult for people like me to get at the causes of climate change. And that's a deep, deep concern that we may no longer be able to continuously monitor stuff that we urgently need to monitor, not only for climate, but also for basic weather prediction. For example, if you stop monitoring atmospheric moisture, then you degrade the quality of weather forecasts that give you early warning of severe storms, of atmospheric rivers. It's unthinkable to actually kill those kind of critically important measurements, but yet that's where we are. It's heartbreaking. I have hundreds of colleagues at the National Center for Atmospheric Research, at the Geophysical Fluid Dynamics Lab, at the Goddard Institute for Space Studies, women and men who have devoted their entire scientific careers to trying to model the climate system, understand the climatic shape of things to come. Many of them, particularly probationary employees, are gone. And you can't flip a switch under a more enlightened administration, which, you know, we hope we get in 3 years from now, and bring all of that back. Science doesn't work that way. Many of the best and the brightest will leave the country and will go to Europe or go to China or go to Japan or Australia. They will leave the United States. They will see no future for themselves there. Or they won't even come to the country to study, to do degrees. And that loss of talented, dedicated researchers is heartbreaking. That's the only word for it.
And you mentioned, obviously, a lot of the programs that have been cut, for example, monitoring. Do you think other countries can step into the void? And kind of, if so, who and how?
I hope so. I hope the Europeans and the Chinese and the Australians and the Japanese are making serious contingency plans and recognizing that this is a real thing. The Trump administration is going to turn off satellites. They've announced their intent to severely cut NASA and go after things like the orbiting carbon observatory and other remote sensing systems that make measurements that they don't like. So hopefully other space agencies recognize the danger to this evidentiary chain. But again, that's not like flipping a switch that you can suddenly launch a satellite. Developing sensors, deploying sensors in space, all of that is the stuff of years, not the stuff of a couple of months. But I hope that these kind of discussions are going on at the highest level in countries that recognize the value of information. Again, not only for climate, but for basic weather forecasting. If the U.S. no longer is willing to lead, is no longer willing to invest in basic monitoring of weather and climate, other countries have to try and fill the gap.
Shortly before Trump won his second term, you wrote that his election risks trapping the US and the planet in an eddy of ignorance. I wonder what your reflections are now that Trump is in power.
We're in that eddy of ignorance in the United States. Clearly, this administration seeks to redefine reality itself, seeks in its public-facing websites, say NASA, EPA, to generate a picture of a world where climate isn't changing, or if it is, the changes are purely natural. They're due to the sun, volcanoes, orbital perturbations. Humans have no agency, have no discernible influence on climate. So they're creating an alternative universe in which human-caused fossil fuel burning has no impact on climate. And what do you even call that? Eddy of ignorance is too weak a term to describe that willful misrepresentation of the world we actually live in, of the climate we actually live in, of how it's changed, of how it's likely to change. It's, again, heartbreaking when you think of the destruction of information on websites, the destruction of libraries, like, as has recently been reported, the Goddard Space Flight Center library of volumes about atmospheric science, ocean science. The thought of that stuff going away, of not being there anymore, I don't know what to do with that, I guess. The only thing I can do with it and have tried to do with that kind of willful ignorance is shine a light on it and say this is wrong. No matter what differences in political positions we have, we all lose if we embrace ignorance with open arms and claim that the real world is what the president believes it to be, not what we actually measure and monitor. It's that that's where we are in the United States. President Trump is defining reality, and we risk, as many have written, going back to the Soviet Lysenkoism, you know, where any science that conflicts with the prevailing political views of the leader is dismissed and denied, and that has serious negative consequences, of course, not only for the U.S., but for the entire world. We're part of the problem now in the United States, not part of the solution to the problem of climate change.
You are listening to atmospheric scientist Ben Santer speaking with Carbon Brief in 2026, why he had to leave American science behind.
You mentioned the Department of Energy earlier and its involvement in the Lawrence Livermore lab. And I wonder what your reaction was to their critical review on climate change that they published last year.
Yeah, so they published this review in July of 2025. It involved five noted climate change skeptics. I had dealt with all of them over the course of my time at Livermore. It was not a surprise that the administration was going to try and come up with some counter-narrative to IPCC and national climate assessments. But what did surprise me was just how brazen and blatantly wrong bits of it were. So I'll give you an example. Chapter 5.5 of this Department of Energy Climate Working Group review dealt with temperature changes in the stratosphere. And it touched on work that my colleagues and I had done and published most recently in 2023 in a paper in Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. And the DOE report cited our 2023 paper and said that we had not found a human fingerprint on climate. We had found the most convincing evidence yet of a human fingerprint on the structure of atmospheric temperature, this predicted fingerprint of warming of the lower atmosphere and cooling of the upper atmosphere, predicted by Suki Manabe back in 1967. We had found it in satellite measurements of atmospheric temperature change, and we had found that this signal was particularly clear where Manabe had predicted back in 67 that it would be clear. Right in the upper stratosphere. The Department of Energy, in saying you didn't find a fingerprint, was essentially doing the equivalent of something like this. The walls here in this room are white. They're essentially telling you, no, they're not white, they're black. What do you do with something like that when someone mischaracterizes your own work and the work of your colleagues, sober, mature science that you've spent decades doing, and fundamentally turns it on its head in an official government report for a specific political purpose? You know, the report was released on the same day as EPA Administrator Lee Zeldin announced his intent to repeal the 2009 endangerment finding, the finding that emissions of greenhouse gases through their effect on on temperature and through temperature effects on air pollution materially harm human health. So this report fed into that political goal of wanting to repeal the endangerment finding, and our science is being misrepresented to support that political goal. That was pretty shocking to me that it would be so blatant. There was no pretense really of trying to get the science right. And the example that I just mentioned with our vertical fingerprint work with atmospheric temperature is only one example of many dozens that the Dessler report, this takedown, and Carbon Brief's own takedown of the many errors in the DOE report showed. This was a pattern of behavior. My job is about pattern analysis, and there was a pattern in the DOE report of trying to misrepresent well-understood science.
Your career has spanned periods where climate science has been attacked quite fiercely. Look back to the time of Kyoto in the 90s or ClimateGate at the end of the 2000s. What parallels or differences do you see today?
So back in the mid-90s, the attacks focused on the IPCC's second assessment report. That report came out in early 1996, and its headline finding was the infamous 12-word statement, "The balance of evidence suggests a discernible human influence on global climate." And that was significant because it was the first time that the international scientific community said formally, "We see a signal of human activity." Other individual scientists had made such claims in the past, notably Jim Hansen in 1988 in a paper in Journal of Geophysical Research. But this was the international community, the IPCC, saying, "Hey, humans are no longer innocent bystanders in the climate system. We've formally identified a climate change signal due to our actions. It's not the sun, it's not volcanoes, it's not natural internal variability, it's on us." And as the play Kyoto, which you just mentioned, clearly notes, that was threatening, that discernible human influence finding, to very powerful moneyed interests, to, for example, the Global Climate Coalition, a consortium of energy interests. They recognized that this was bad for business, that this finding might have downstream implications for their business models, for their ability to continue burning fossil fuels without considering the negative externalities of their actions. So the Global Climate Coalition and other fossil fuel funded organizations, Western Fuels, the Petroleum Association, went after the IPCC and went after me. No personal animus, but I was the lead author of the chapter in which this finding was situated. And individual folks in Congress, too, like Dana Rohrabacher, a Republican congressman, wanted to make names for themselves and felt that they could do so by casting doubt on the integrity of the IPCC process, the scientific integrity of people like me. So there was some attempt back then to politicize the science, too. It wasn't just fossil fuel interests that went after the IPCC. It was also folks like Rohrabacher who wanted to make a name for themselves. What's different today is that it's an entire administration. You know, this is institutionalized willful ignorance on the part of the administration, institutionalized efforts to destroy the U.S. capability to monitor, measure, and understand changes in Earth's climate. That's qualitatively different from anything I encountered in the mid-90s at the time of the IPCC's second assessment report.
And if you were in the earlier stages of your career now, as you were then, do you think you would be just as involved in communication and public engagement on climate change?
Absolutely. The lesson I learned 30 years ago, back at the time of the discernible human influence finding in 1996, was sometimes you don't have the luxury of sitting on the fence and just waiting to see how things develop. Back then, I was a representative of an entire scientific community. My job had been to, with my peers, assess the then available science and come up with our best representation of what the science back then, 30 years, told us. And we did. And we were right. The cautious, even wimpy balance of evidence suggests a discernible human influence on global climate was justified by the then available science. And in the next 30 years, the science progressed. better models, longer data records, better fingerprint techniques for disentangling human and natural effects on climate, more scientists involved in this kind of work all over the world, leading to the word unequivocal. It is now unequivocal, as the IPCC judged in its 2021 sixth assessment report, that there are human fingerprints all over Earth's climate system, atmosphere, oceans, land surface. Back then in 1995, 1996, we were primarily looking at surface thermometer records, surface temperature records. Now, folks have interrogated literally dozens of variables. Arctic sea ice extent, atmospheric moisture, specific humidity, sea level pressure, ocean heat content, clouds, circulation patterns, extreme event properties, you name it, they've looked at it. They've kicked the tires. They've used pattern recognition methods to assess whether purely natural influences can explain the changes in each of those independently measured variables. Natural causes can't. And that's the frustration, I would say, this disconnect between this much more mature understanding of causes now in 2021 and this willful ignorance that we see in the Trump administration, where the president of your own country refers to all of the work that you've done and your colleagues have done as a con job. So not only wrong, but criminal, as if there's intent on your part and your colleagues' part to mislead the global public about the reality and seriousness of climate change. The only response, in my opinion, is you have to, as a scientist, push back against that. If you don't, if you remain silent, then really bad stuff happens. And I think that's true for our democracy as well. If good people remain silent when there are serious challenges facing science and democracy, we all lose.
That was internationally known scientist Ben Santer with Robert McSweeney of Carbon Brief, recorded in January 2026. You can hear my own interview with Ben Santer on Radio EcoShock in January 2021, just as he was defunded by Trump. Links at ecoshock.org.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Remember, folks, yeah, it's all a hoax. Yeah. Take what I tell you, not what you see. No.
The Trump climate massacre and denial revival, it's so brazen. But his donors and cronies silence corporate media. We need to hear independent voices. Here you go. Reaction from five countries. Let's start, though, with a brief clip of Donald Trump himself at the United Nations explaining his climate views.
In 1982, the executive director of the United Nations Environmental Program predicted that by the year 2000, climate change would cause a global catastrophe. He said that it will be irreversible, as any nuclear holocaust would be. This is what they said at the United Nations. What happened? Here we are. Another UN official stated in 1989 that within a decade, entire nations could be wiped off the map by global warming. Not happening. You know, it used to be global cooling. If you look back years ago in the 1920s and the 1930s, they said global cooling will kill the world. We have to do something. Then they said global warming will kill the world. But then it started getting cooler. So now they could just call it climate change, because that way they can't miss. It's climate change. Because if it goes higher or lower, whatever the hell happens, there's climate change. It's the greatest con job ever perpetrated on the world, in my opinion. Climate change, no matter what happens, you're involved in that. No more global warming, no more global cooling. All of these predictions made by the United Nations and many others, often for bad reasons, were wrong. They were made by stupid people that have cost their country's fortunes and given those same countries no chance for success. If you don't get away from this green scam, your country is going to fail. And I'm really good at predicting things, you know. They actually said during the campaign they had a hat, the best-selling hat. Trump was right about everything.